So I thought my dog was in the kitchen, and he wasn't. So I walked into my room, and he'd eaten my whole bag of Twizzlers. Seriously, so mad. LOL.
Okay, and welcome back to Conspiranormal. This is your host, Adam Sane.
And this is your bro, Luke Reed.
Alright, Luke. I understand that you've become a lifeguard.
Yes. I think you might have mentioned that in one of the last episodes, but yeah, I'm guarding lives.
That's pretty scary, man.
It is. Yeah, even for me, it's a
little scary. Guarding some lives is really...
You know, and I don't even remember half the stuff.
Let the fat chicks drown and then get the hot ones.
Save the cute, young, skinny
ones. It's going to be a hot one and a fat one, and you're going to be like, whatever, the fat one will float.
I'll be like, lifeguard needs assistance over there. I got this one.
Well, anyway, I just wanted to talk about, real quick, the bombing in Boston. I figure enough time has gone by to where we can kind of talk about it with a better perspective than most people have talked about it.
Okay.
I just wanted to kind of get your thoughts on some of it first before we went on.
Well, first of all, I've been so busy with everything going on right now that I haven't been paying any attention to the news.
Yeah.
But, you know... They got into a debate, I saw, like, on Fox and everything about the drones that they were using and if they should have used the surveillance drones to find the guy that I can't pronounce his name.
Tomerlan Sarnayev and his brother Zokor.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, and they were using drones to try to find him. They found him up underneath that boat, and they ripped the tarp with that that tank, the SWAT tank.
Well, supposedly he was hiding out in a boat.
Yeah.
And the guy had seen, like, a pool of blood, like a path of blood leading up to his boat.
Right.
And so he had called the police, which, you know, here's the guy just laying there in the boat bleeding. And, you know, he doesn't really just even go over there and just decide, you know, hey, maybe this guy's just really hurt. And, you know, of course he calls the police, but he might have been able to do something else before they shot the boat up. And, of course, there's all sorts of conflicting information about that. But this is what I think has happened with the whole Boston Marathon bombing.
Listening.
I believe that it was probably an FBI setup. The FBI has been known to set people up from time to time. It's kind of like a form of entrapment. Where they find these people, and usually young men, usually around between the ages of 19 and 30, and they get them to go ahead and they set it up with them. One FBI agent acts like they're gonna help them out, and they're gonna supply them with bombs or some other material in order to do a terrorist attack. There was a case in point where a Somali national who was in the United States was wanted to bomb the Portland, Oregon Christmas tree in 2009, and he had been set up and by the FBI. The FBI had been the ones that were calling him, talking to him, and helping him set it up, and then at the last minute, they go in and swoop in. So I think that that's probably what happened with Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and that they had him probably set up to take the fall.
That they were gonna
swoop in at the last minute and say, okay, well, hey, we look good. The FBI looks really good. We just prevented a major bombing.
Right.
But somehow, he probably really outsmarted them. So that's what I think is more than likely the case. It's possible that he, and I'm talking about the older brother because I think the younger brother was just an accomplice.
Right.
I think he's just proud, you know, how it is.
The older brother had all the plans.
Right. It's like, you know, your brother, you know, you got an older brother. you know, you kind of look up to him, and
yeah,
and when she's been on the show, and you you know, you look up to him, and that's, you know, you just become an accomplice, probably from some kind of pressure he's getting from his older brother. Mm-hmm. What I found most interesting about this whole thing was this, what had happened in Boston that Friday while they were looking for the younger brother after they shot the older one. They shot him. And of course, there's been some odd things about that. And mother has come out and said that supposedly there was a naked man that was shown being arrested on Friday, and his mother said that that was Tamberlin, the older brother.
Here we go, the identity confusion
right,
again.
Right, and so, you know, things just get confused. But they shot, the younger brother was shot, and as I said before, he's running around the city pretty much bleeding to death. And what do they do in Boston? They got like three other like police departments together. Cops are out there with like armored vehicles and tanks and dressed in military fatigues, telling people to get out of their houses, telling people to stay in their houses.
Yeah, which is most likely like a too big of a display, just to demonstrate their power, you know, over their authority, just to further.
It's also a violation of the Fourth Amendment
to further push their authority. Yeah.
Which is, you know, unwarranted search and seizure. You can't. I saw a picture of a woman coming out of her apartment, and the two cops or two or three of them in SWAT gear got their guns pointed at her. You know, obviously she's an accomplice. You know, and the little kids that were in the houses and the people that were just an accomplice, they were all accomplices. You know, this whole idea of everybody's guilty is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And that kind of movement makes me really think that maybe there was some other kind of pre-planned thing that was going on, that maybe that was just an excuse just to show a gross amount of power and see what we can do. You know, it was very much just like what the definition of martial law.
So do you think that it's a possibility that this person was already planning the attack, the FBI knew and allowed it to happen? Or do you think that the FBI set it all up from the get-go, like, you know, made him do it and everything?
Yeah, well, I think that what it was that what I personally think, my theory, is that they were going to set him up and they were going to come in at the last minute and they were going to catch him in the act. And for some reason, I don't know what that reason is, he outsmarted him. I'm talking about Tamberlin.
Oh, gotcha.
Somehow, he somehow, because the FBI has been known to supply materials, but it's usually been fake materials. So maybe he decided, maybe he caught on to it, and maybe said, okay, well, I'll just go to some other plan. So I think the FBI really screwed it up.
Yeah.
And it happened.
Yeah.
And it wasn't supposed to play out the way it was. There are several things, like, you know, Alex Jones on his website, he had these pictures on of basically people in the crowd around the marathon with, you obviously could see they had like earpieces in their head, you know, they looked kind of military, and, you know, I think that could easily explain, the FBI theory could easily explain that, because they were probably guys that were watching those two guys, and they they messed up.
Yeah.
Somebody messed up.
Yeah. Do you think
that there's a possibility? There's always a possibility it was allowed to happen, but I think it's just a screw up, and I think you're probably going to see a bunch of FBI officials start resigning.
Yeah,
here in the next
true.
Few months.
We'll have to look out for that. Then we'll have to watch for that.
What were you going to ask me?
But do you think there's anything behind this whole passing CISPA the same time that this whole deal with the marathon's been going on?
Quite truly, I don't know. There's always a distraction, though, whenever kind of that legislation like that goes through.
I haven't really looked at the bill closely or anything like that, but it seems like a pretty big deal. I mean, because just like a warrant search and seizure, like you were just talking about with the boat, now they can do that on people's computers. And, you know, they've been spying all along with the hidden Microsoft files and everything else. But now it's just blatantly like, hey, we're allowed to do this, and we don't care.
thank you. Thank you, Bill Gates. Yeah. Apple's about the same.
Right.
You know, they're
worse, yeah. They're worse.
Of course, I love my iPhone. What can I say? You know, I'm just jacked into the system, I guess.
And once again, I'm anti-Apple everything.
Yeah, I've noticed.
Any device that takes away your user control is just worthless to me.
Yeah. So, that's what I think is going on. I think it was an FBI setup. I haven't heard a lot of people talk about this. I've heard the whole false flag meme going on. I don't think that this was false flag in the sense that it was government that did it, but it's very possible that a government agency, this was just a big screw up.
Yeah.
It's also possible that this Tamerlan guy, you know, he had been contacted by the FBI. The FBI had been watching him. So, that to me it puts a red flag up to think that maybe, you know, the FBI was trying to set him up.
Yeah.
And that they were going to look really good, saying, hey, somebody's going to try to bomb Boston Marathon, but we look what we did. And
swoop in like heroes.
Mess it up.
Now's the perfect time for some Alex Jones voices, you know, to go in with all of the characters.
And he was on there, he's just like, it's a false flag attack! My God! Ah!
How can you people not see this?
How can you not see it? And he immediately called it as a false flag. One of his guys was in the crowd. I think I mentioned this. He was at a press conference. I think I mentioned this, although I didn't know at the time it was one of Alex Jones' guys on our last show. We recorded that like right the day that happened. Mm-hmm. And one of his guys was in there just saying, hey, is this a false flag to take away our rights? And the governor of the state of Massachusetts says, just looks at him and says, no. You know, so
that was easy.
Yeah. Well, the one interesting thing about the governor of Massachusetts was he was at a press conference, and he was asked whether he'd seen the video. Supposedly there's a video out there that shows the two brothers placing these bombs, okay, in the crowd, that they're actually putting them down. And what happens is somebody asked him about that, and he says, well, have you seen the video? And he said, no, I haven't seen the video, but it's been described to me. Wow. I mean, who is... First of all, who's describing it to him? And second of all, why can't the governor of the state of Massachusetts see a video that lasts probably about 30 seconds of that?
Well, I mean,
it doesn't make any sense at all to me.
Yeah, I don't know about all that, though. I mean, because he's probably a really busy man.
Yeah, but I mean, something like that happens, a bombing that kills four people and wounds a whole bunch of other people.
Yeah, at the Boston Marathon. Though. You're right, though, because that does seem... detrimental that he watches that video. I mean, that's pretty
very
important.
Very odd. He should watch that. He should see that. Be able to see that video.
That's pretty important to him.
That's very, very strange. And you always have strange things about this. And the thing is that, you know, false flag attack or not, on this one, I don't think we're ever going to get the full story.
No,
we're never going to know the
Who
full
does?
Story. Just like Sandy Hook. We're never going to know
Mexican
that story.
Gangsters raiding school.
Uh-huh. And we're never going to know what exactly happened.
No.
Because it will eventually come down to us as some kind of whitewashed, just a whitewashed story.
That's how it works.
Yep. You and I know that. I think most of our audience probably does too.
Yep.
But anyway, I think we've bored them enough, so... We're going to go ahead and contact our guest here in a second. His name is Adam Ellenboss, and he has written a book called Fishers of Men. Came out about 3 years ago, and it is about an ayahuasca vision quest that he went on. And I just finished the book today, and I must say that it's probably one of the best books I've ever read.
There you go.
Not necessarily because of the ayahuasca aspect, but he gets into a lot of personal things, and the guy is a hell of a writer. So we're going to go to him, and we'll be right back on Conspiranormal. Okay, and we are back on Conspiranormal. You know me. This is Adam.
This is Luke.
And we have on the line Adam Ellenboss. So you need to, you know, make it known who you're speaking to, Luke, because we got the same name. So,
gotcha.
But as I mentioned before, Adam is the author of a book called Fishers of Men, and it is an excellent book about the gospel of an ayahuasca vision quest. And he has the rights for the Reality Sandwich blog. And I just wanted to get him on here. I wanted to talk about his experiences with ayahuasca, which I know is something that you're particularly interested in, Luke.
Oh, yes.
So, Adam, we just want to welcome you to the show.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. It's cool to be here. I like what you guys are up to.
Thank you. I just wanted to kind of get to, you know, tell people that are not familiar with who you are. I mean, who you are, you know, tell us about what it is that you do. And just like what ayahuasca is, if nobody's, but maybe some people may not be familiar with it, what it is.
Sure. So I'm one of the contributing or one of the founding writers now, sort of contributing editors of a website called Reality Sandwich, and it's kind of a web magazine devoted to all things human consciousness, the evolution of human consciousness. You know, sustainability, permaculture, conspiracy theory, aliens, crop circles, psychedelics, it kind of runs the gamut. So that's one thing. That's kind of how I got started in this line of work. I was a graduate student, and I started writing for them. Through working with ayahuasca, kind of an entire spiritual path opened up for me. And now I co-own a yoga studio called Sky House Yoga, which is here in Silver Spring, Maryland. And I'm also kind of my full-time job is that I'm a professional astrologer. I own an astrology school called Nightlight Astrology. So we have, you know, students that study with us at our school year-round, and different teachers, different astrologers that come in from all over the country to teach various styles of astrology. And you know, other than that, I like to write, of course. So I'm working on a second book right now. But that's me, and you know, if you don't know ayahuasca, my first book was obviously about ayahuasca, and that's really what opened everything up for me. And ayahuasca is a the sort of sacred plant tea that's made in the Amazon. It's prepared by the cooking of a particular leaf from the jungle and a particular type of vine, and they're cooked together in water in a pot over fire for a long period of time, and kind of boiled down into a sludgy, kind of disgusting tasting tea. And then, you know, people, we drink this tea with a shaman. People do this, and of course, this goes back many hundreds, perhaps even thousands of years. And after drinking this sort of psychedelic potion, you have. So it's some people describe it like you know, it's like lucid dreaming, you know, but you're completely awake. Other people describe it as like, you know, psychotherapy on steroids, and you know, it's a very unique otherworldly experience. It's not unlike any other variety of mystical experiences from, you know, Vipassana retreats where you're in silence meditating for 10 days straight, or intense vision quests into the wilderness, or anything like that. It's an experience that people go to for a lot of different reasons, and generally come out with some pretty similar kind of mystical results that help people find a sense of meaning or a path or connection to God or the universe.
Adam, what was your motivation in taking it? Why did you want to take it? What did you hope to get out of that experience?
Well, I think it was a channel of sorts. A channel of information and of experience that was opening in my life at the time that I was very curious about. I had had a number of psychedelic experiences with other drugs, mushrooms. Of course, I use the word drug very, very lightly. I think many, you know, most early people on our planet that used these substances considered them sacraments or medicines.
Yeah.
And so, you know, mushrooms and a number of other psychedelic experiences, and really, it just really started opening my mind to sort of two very different realities that I was living with. And one was sort of this hyper-analytical, Western, materialistic, empirical, you know, secular, materialist, that whole thing. And then there was this other side that was really active and dynamic and intuitive and completely paradoxical and mysterious, and yet, you know, the ground of much of my being and much of my life was this other sort of mystical side of my consciousness, dreams, and, you know, and anything else that just, you know, that sort of more intuitive. And really, I was in graduate school. I was studying creative writing, and I had the opportunity to create an independent study in travel writing. And I just decided, you know, I'd read about ayahuasca and also iboga, which is another very powerful plant substance. It's, you know, sort of like the mothership of all psychedelic experiences. And I think I was just kind of, you know, it's like skydiving. I was like, well, I want to push myself to the limits, I guess. I really want to see what's out there. And I can just consider myself a seeker, I guess. And, yeah. And so it was really just a combination of an adventure and just a really deep desire to break free of the mundane answers that were sort of being handed to me by culture.
What did you call the other plant that you just mentioned there again?
The other plant is called iboga. And actually, both plants are used quite frequently all around the world now for the treatment of addiction. There's actually, you know, many centers now that have kind of opened up in various parts of the world. You can go and use ayahuasca or iboga in more like clinical settings for the treatment of addiction. It's incredibly good at getting you to sort of like, it just sort of rings you by the neck and is like, knock it off to any stupid self-destructive behaviors you have going on.
Wow. That, I have to give that a try.
It's kind, and it has a good sense of humor too. So it's, you know, it's a beautiful experience.
Speaking about the experiences, what were some of the personal experiences that you had with ayahuasca?
Well, it's you know, immediately it's hard to answer because I've had several hundred now. So
yeah.
This has become, you know, a path for me, a practice of sorts. I think some of my first very personal experiences were, you know, in what I wrote my book about, why I called the book The Gospel of an Ayahuasca Vision Quest and Fishers of Men, is really because my first visions were, completely deconstructing the punitive sort of patriarchal sky god archetype that I had, you know, grown up with and watched my parents struggle with as people who, you know, my mom was... grew up Catholic. My dad grew up in sort of a free Methodist / Calvinist environment. So both of them were inundated by a version of God that they really tried to come to grips with during the 1960s and 70s as they were coming of age. And they went into the ministry, I think, as I've understood it, as sort of like a reformers. And some of the reformative attitudes that they had were shaped by psychedelics in the 60s and bands like the Beatles and the Beach Boys. And
yeah.
And yet they still really love Jesus, you know? So for me, it was like sorting out a lot of mixed up religious baggage in my first ceremonies. And specifically, you know, through some very, very powerful and emotive visions of Jesus and other Christian archetypes like archangels and the Virgin Mary and even saying these things, it sounds cheesy. You simply can't describe, even by naming these things, what it's like to have these kinds of visions with them, you know?
I got a lot of questions for you because, like Adam had said, it's always been in the back of my mind, if I ever have some money put together someday to, I don't know if you've ever heard of it, Blue Morpho in Peru.
Yeah, that's where I first went. Blue Morpho was the first lodge that I ever went to. It was right before, I can't remember, it was like within a month of the time that Kira Salek went down and had this amazing experience. Of course, she's a well-known journalist who ended up writing a very pivotal article for the whole field of ayahuasca shamanism and ayahuasca tourism to South America. She wrote this article for National Geographic called To Hell and Back, something like that. And that was an experience that she had with Hamilton and Alberto and Julio, who were Alberto and Julio are Hamilton's teachers. Hamilton's this young guy. He's like an Aries, super adventurous entrepreneur and really smart and kind of bold character. And, you know, I went down there and had these experiences with him and his teachers over the course of my first several times down there. And it was just sort of phenomenal because it was at this very time that ayahuasca was, like, you know, sort of breaking headlines in these big magazines. And then Blue Morpho was at the head of that. And mm-hmm. so I was there before the big lodge got built, when it was back, when the first lodge was, like, back, you know, 24 hours upriver, and it was way back there. And of course now it's like on the outskirts of the city, and a lodge has been built up, and that's all good, that's fine, but it's been fascinating to watch the whole thing you know, develop from the beginning. So, but yeah, short answer is yes, I know Blue Morpho.
A couple of those names that you just mentioned sound familiar, especially Julio. I think he was in the documentary Metamorphosis.
That's right. Yeah, I'm. You know, Alberto was in that documentary. Julio passed away, I think, before the documentary was shot.
Oh, okay. All right, go ahead, Adam.
Okay.
I'll ask some more questions in a minute.
Well, you talked about you know, when you saw Jesus, and that's a pretty it's a pretty interesting part of the book, interesting section. I mean, when you saw him, you met him, you had that encounter, how did he differ from what you were brought up to believe about him?
Well, in a couple of ways. One, and I mean, this is, and I say this not to, like, be sensationalist, right, but to really, the end effect being to ground the character of Jesus.
Yeah.
But the first thing was that I recognized was that this person was, not like fully enlightened, like there's some terminal state that you reach where it's just over and done or something, but this was like, it was like meeting an alien, and I don't mean alien in some kind of movie, you know, creepy whatever. I mean,
sure,
it was as though I was encountering a being who was human, but who within the human form was at a sort of vibrational level of peace and love and power that was truly otherworldly, and immediately made me feel like the cosmos was just completely infinite. And that was what was, you know, probably the most powerful thing before there was any kind of interaction on a more personal level. It was just the presence of this being who made me realize that, you know, I think we have a really, even though we're like, a lot of us have kind of evolved, and we're like, you know, I think the cosmos is a pretty big place, and there's probably aliens out there, and there's probably other life forms or whatever. I don't think that we truly grasp, even with that kind of openness, the sort of infinitude that we're dealing with here. You know, so it's like this vision, first and foremost, just ratched that open for me. It was like, wow, I'm living in the infinite, and this person is something like a really well-seasoned, incredibly elevated master of traveling and being sort of in a very deep state of complete union with this universe and with God, if God can be called the universe, or maybe transcendent to it. I don't know, and I'm not sure it even really matters. It was just that powerful. And then I think the second thing that came in, you know, after that was just the gut level response of feeling that I wasn't worthy. And there's a story, you know, that goes with that in the actual vision. But, you know, the short of it was that in the presence of what had happened originally was I was laying on a mattress, and I knocked a cup of water over, and so, you know, my arm basically went into the water, and I was, you know, drifting into a trance with my arm in the water. And it suddenly felt as though the entire room was surrounded with these sort of like pillars, like Greek columns, And there were actual big, huge poles in the room that helped to create that part of the effect. Kind of like when you're dreaming, if you're touching water, you might see a waterfall or something. It had that kind of a presence. But then within the domain that was created through that sort of visceral, and effect, then I saw Jesus walking on water. And then this feeling that I just described was there. And then after that, the basic of what happened was that I felt incredibly unworthy and very far from the power and presence and whatever that Jesus was carrying or emanating. And in that response, there was a teaching. And the teaching was about, it's that level of reactiveness that we have, or that it's that tendency to react when we see something great, when we feel something great, to suddenly stop identifying with it and step into a comparison. And when we stop identifying with love, we step out of love. Like when we make a comparison and say, oh, I am not that love, or I am not that Jesus, or I am not that whatever. And we isolate ourselves and we essentially cut ourselves off. And so what I realized was that there was, in that vision, then there was a deep sense of like how guilt and ashamedness is something that we inflict upon ourselves that essentially cuts us off from the power of Christ consciousness, or the power of Buddha consciousness, or the power of love, or the vastness, the mystery of the cosmos. And that all we really have to do is let go of that reactive tendency to compare ourselves to love. And so that was like an immensely powerful teaching. It made me vomit. It propelled me through an entire sequence of purging, which is a part of an ayahuasca ceremony too, where your body will start to sort of psychosomatically release or act out the degree to which a pattern of self-destruction is entrenched within the body. And then it starts to release that pattern through the process of the vision. And so as that was happening, it was just a teaching to me of like, be like me, identify with me. And that's what it means to have Jesus in your heart. And that was like Jesus and Christianity 5.0 just instantly uploaded into my framework,
That's great.
As I understand it, the purging can take many different forms, but it's not just vomiting. It can be any.
Right, sometimes they dry heave too.
Which I believe that's happened to you, Adam, dry heaving.
Say that again?
Like dry heaving is another form of purging.
Oh yeah, gosh. I've just purged like every possible way that there is to purge. It's barfing, crying, going out the bottom, laughing, sighing, burping, hiccuping, shaking, thrashing, kicking, trying, and some of it can get pretty dark. Sometimes people have to get restrained or brought in and held under water to help cool down the effects, because this is a lot of the times just completely shattering people's psyche. And because the power of what you're seeing and going through is not just a teaching in some abstract intellectual way. These teachings appear in contrast, generally speaking, to things that we have living inside of us. And this is where I started getting interested in astrology, because it was quite clearly the case through my experiences that these were karmic. These are things that came down through my family line. These are things that came down through culture and history. And also, it's not far-fetched at all when you're having these experiences to feel the presence of having been human before. And whether that's genetics or something that lives inside of us or literal past lives, I'm not sure it matters. But you feel that those things are so real, and so you want to you want to discover more, because there is a sort of a sacred science at play. Although it can be a real red herring to like want to come away from an ayahuasca experience and try to figure things out. But I mean, in general, yeah, you can purge in any number of ways, and it's not even how you purge. you know, it's just that the specific way in which you purged is oftentimes just unspeakably and ironically bound up with the thing itself that you're purging, you know. So a lot of times people with, you know, real serious tendencies, right? Like, the way that they're going to come out is going to be to, like, you know, like they're sounding like a bear who's trying to fight against something because they have this serious disposition. And then after a while, it just breaks open and the person can't stop laughing for an hour, you know, and like that is for that person just liberating until they get to the point where that liberation of laughter from this enclosed, crystallized, serious attitude toward life is then frightening. They realize how deep laughter has been buried, and after an hour of laughing, they're absolutely terrified by how deep the laughter goes. And so they'll vomit because they have to get over the fact that fear was driving the seriousness from the beginning, right? So it can be like there's any number of ways that these things act themselves out, and you can always kind of sense with it a kind of like a little bit of a physics or a logic at play. And that's what makes the experience, I think, also like something that could possibly be of huge beneficial interest to medical doctors and therapists and psychiatrists. So I personally hope there's more research done, you know.
Adam, would you say that one experience would permanently make an impact on your life and the way you lived afterward, or would you say it's more of like, I need to go back and do this again to kind of reassert what I learned the first time?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, the way that I typically answer that question, because I think it's a perennial one that we ask not just of ayahuasca, right? But like when I was a kid, you know, my dad was a preacher, and I would go to youth group. And, like, the same kids were going up to altar calls to get saved every Wednesday. Like, what happened from last week to this week that, like, Jesus is, like, no longer your friend or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that as I have grown older, what I've come to understand is that, you know, baptism, for example, the concept of baptism or communion, these things are, to my mind, they're really, in some ways, the exact same gesture. They are a recommitting of oneself, to the way, to the Tao, to God, to Christ, to the Buddha, whatever. And people need to do them again and again and again, as often as the sun rises. You know, it's a daily part of our life to renew the practice of our faith, because faith, in my estimation, faith is a journey, and faith is a practice. So in that regard, people that drink ayahuasca, if they go looking for something that's going to, like, cure them, I mean, it's undeniable that ayahuasca, compared to many other things, and this is a fair comparison that I don't feel bad to make, is that ayahuasca can crack you open in a way that not a lot of things can. And it has to be used very respectfully as a result, because the other thing is that because it cracks you open like not a lot of other things can, there's also a temptation to come back from an experience like that hugely self-righteous, right? Because, you know, it's like imagine that you could inject a year's worth of Pentecostal, very personal Pentecostal experiences into 6 hours, right? Mm-hmm. And you may come off from that like a little bit of a firebrand, you know? So I think that's what I've noticed the most, is that people who go in with the idea that it's going to blow them apart in this and just totally give them the answers, they come back thinking that they have the answers. And the practice is not about having answers. That, you know, it's in my, you know, in my estimation, it's about learning to walk a path daily with, you know, integrity. So, you know, people come back from ayahuasca, and I think for a lot of people, it becomes a path. They'll drink in 4 or 5 ceremonies. They'll come home with, maybe in another year or two, they'll go down and drink again. And it becomes a sort of, it's like a strange portal through which you can just enter into a deep communion with spirit. And as you do that, you know, it's like getting your oil changed in your car, you know, to use a really crappy mechanical metaphor. So, I mean, people use it like that. I think it's wonderful. You have to be careful there's like a whole tourism industry that's built around ayahuasca nowadays. You know, people have died because there's people that are starting to, more people think of it like the answer, the more that people try to make money on it. And that results in crappy shamanism, which results in, you know, people getting overdosed or the brew not being served or cooked correctly or whatever. So it's a complex topic. Myself, for me, it's very important to take time away from spiritual practice and to just be a human, you know, and then to go back to spiritual practice and then to go back to being human. It's like a dance that I personally have to do. And I always tell people, go and just do, you know, do ayahuasca, like, you know, maybe have that attitude will help.
Wow. Now, Adam, in your book, you pretty much go through your entire life story. And you talk about the way you were before you had these experiences, that you had issues with drug addiction, sexual addiction, those type of things. And now, after you've had these experiences with ayahuasca, that is completely out of your life. It's like your wiring has just been changed.
Right. Yeah, that's, I mean, it's a process. So it's like, it didn't happen overnight. There were a few minor setbacks, but I mean minor. And that's a great thing about ayahuasca is that, I mean, in terms of the substances and the addictions and whatnot, you know, ego issues, they take a little bit longer, you know, but the actual substance addictions and the sex, you know, sexual addictions, those things got cleaned up pretty quickly. Well, one thing that really, it just changed the, I mean, I heard a shaman in South America say that, you know, you need to be careful when you come back from an ayahuasca ceremony, in South America, going back to the United States, that you have time and space to reintegrate slowly, because ayahuasca is like a form of brain surgery almost. I mean, it's a very, delicate, you know, and sensitive process. And what you go through is, you know, I mean, you really are getting into the wiring, hardcore karmic wiring, and also physiological stuff. So, you know, for me, one of the instant things that I realized when I came back, which is in keeping with almost, I think some of the great wisdom traditions in our planet, certainly Taoism and Eastern Chinese medicine, which is this idea that the body is, especially men's bodies, are often very depleted by ejaculation or by ejaculatory orgasm. And so one of the things that just became very obvious to me afterwards, because ayahuasca in a sense sensitizes a lot of people to the deeper levels of subtle feeling that go along with phenomenal reality, like drinking a beer, or like, you know, having sex or whatever. And it, you know, for a long time it was my body had too much of all of those things, and so I could not do anything. Like I was celibate for a number of years, no women, no sex,
sure,
at all, and, you know, no masturbation either, just totally celibate. And it didn't feel restrictive, you know. You know, for me, it was as though I was just like trying to remember what it's like to not be someone who is triggered to get off by sensory data coming in. And as that developed, you know, a lot of other things are developing. You know, sensitivity to alcohol was higher than ever, so I couldn't drink alcohol. Sensitivity to caffeine, higher than ever, I couldn't have caffeine. A lot of things like that were happening for me, but it was essentially a part of getting sober. But that's a process for me that took, you know, 2-3 years. And I don't mean of going back and forth. I mean, literally of being able to clean and feel pure and strong in my body to sort of revitalize my organs and stuff like that. So then, you know, nowadays I live with a lot of moderation. So I still practice celibacy, but, you know, it's a sort of tantric form of celibacy where I'll have intercourse with my girlfriend, but I will abstain from ejaculations and orgasms. And that's a practice that you can't prescribe to people. You can't prescribe it because any practice, in my opinion, spiritual practice, is only something that you can really come to when you are, it's a big smile and a big yes. It's like, yeah, I'm ready for this. Everyone knows that when you're smoking cigarettes, too. You get to this point where you're like, all right, I can't smoke cigarettes anymore. I'm not liking this. You know, it's not working for me. And it's like there's a willingness that you know what you're going to do is going to feel good, and it does feel good, and so you do it. So that's how these practices came along to me, you know, a gradual sort of reprogramming of a lot of different lifestyle behaviors and patterns, but again, not in a prescriptive way, in a gradually getting acclimated to what I was feeling and what actually felt good and what didn't.
Yeah, it works for you, like the celibacy and such, but it's not something that you would necessarily recommend for someone else unless they came to that realization themselves.
Right.
That's what you're saying?
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, there's two lines of thinking about it. There's one that says meditate because people tell you to and it's good for you and you should do it. And, you know, if you go that way, you can find out that you love meditation, that it's great for you and that people were right and that you were maybe resistant or rebellious to it and you're glad you gave it a shot. That's one way to get there. It doesn't help when you're going that way to have people beat you over the head saying, you know, with fear or judgment or something like that. On the other hand, a fool who persists in his folly becomes wise. And I think that that's more often, especially in America, where, you know, our society is not set up to be as much a community as it is a community that's set up to protect individuals. That kind of atmosphere isn't conducive to communal teachings from elders who say, hey, this really worked for me. There's not enough trust in community in our culture, in my opinion, for something like, hey, try tantric orgasm-free sexuality and see if that changes how quickly you get burnt out on your girlfriend, or you know what I mean? And people will say, well, you know, I don't want to do that because that sounds religious, that sounds whatever. And they're right. It probably does sound that way and feel that way to them. And so the fool who persists in his folly becomes wise. Eventually, what I've noticed is that there are certain types of people, and not everyone is like this, but there are certain types of people who will then go and they will very naturally, as they're progressing on whatever path they're walking down, they will they'll say, you know what, I'm realizing that like sex is this violent sort of loop of insatiable lust for me, and I need to try something different. And that will be the moment at which they try something different. Nothing I say is gonna, you know, mean anything. And that's as it should be, because it only makes sense when it comes through that kind of moment. And it could be something different, too. It could be something that's very specific to what that individual needs to feel a healthy balance, you know?
Right.
But ayahuasca is...
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was going to say, but ayahuasca is something more than it teaches you what to do and what not to do. It really helps you attune, you know, to where your own center point is. It helps you locate your own internal compass. That would be my opinion on it.
You mentioned in the book, too, I believe it's around page 160 in the book, you talk about a dark experience that you had. And it's kind of towards the end, I think towards the end of your time there at the lodge. And you had an experience where you saw a reptilian kind of creature. You had basically what is apocalyptic visions. You know, how did you, are UFOs going through your body? How did you interpret that? What did that mean?
Right. Well, this is actually, I think, a really great point in the book. And one of the parts that was, definitely one of the more difficult parts to write because, you know, at the time it was still really fresh, and so I think it did some really good writing around that, which was also very healing. There was, you know, a couple. I mean, God, at this point, you know, at least, you know, a quarter of my experiences with ayahuasca have been, you know, just hell-raising. And one of the reasons for that is... also, well, because hell and suffering exist. I mean, I don't believe they exist in an eternal sense. But there are regions and dimensions of hell and suffering and great trauma and darkness and even evil, I don't mind saying that word, that exists. And those spaces are spaces that we allow into us through, oftentimes through what we entertain, through what we allow to come into our field, through what we say yes to. And so, or what we don't say no to is maybe a better way of putting it. And so, at any rate, I had, you know, some experiences, incredibly apocalyptic and, you know, all different kinds of sort of, it was very invasive. Like the experience I write about in the book was one that was very dark, very invasive, very sort of, evil. And, that experience was, for me, what that was related to was this subject of alienation. And it was very interesting because the actual words alien and nation kept repeating themselves as separate words and as one word back and forth through many kind of parts of that vision. And
interesting.
Yeah, it was super fascinating. And one of the reasons that I realized this is because, okay, well, to reference a book that I'm reading right now that's really wonderful, this guy Ian McGilchrist, who wrote a book called The Master and His Emissary, The Making of the Split Mind and the Making of the Western World, or The Divided Brain and the Making of the Western World, something like that. Anyway, in the book, he writes about the right and left hemisphere of the brain. And he basically suggests that the right hemisphere is, you know, related to the ground of being, which is essentially the presence of the current moment and the complete stream, like a river of constant change and movement that is the present, and that our right brain lives there, and its understanding of truth is in that movement, that constant, fluid, present movement. The left hemisphere, on the other hand, which he believes is sort of running rampant in the world right now, is one that is built, in a sense, to stand up or out or above that fluid flow in a sort of detached way, scan the area, scan the surroundings, and get this attempt at trying to understand in a detached way why or how something is happening. And yet, what inevitably happens is the left brain will collapse back into the right brain, so that no matter what you do to try and rationalize about your experience, you will return to the fact that your rationalizing is merely another experience flowing through the current moment. Like, okay. So essentially what he says is that the world we live in is trying its best to live through the left brain, which is a very detached, dissociated way of being that tries to rationalize its way through existence rather than identify with the flow of existence. And because of that, what we're doing is we're essentially in this sort of rationalistic mimicry mode. And we are most likely, what we're doing is we're mimicking a mechanical left hemisphere view of reality. So we see things as very robotic. And what that does is it alienates us from the flow of life. By extension, because it alienates us from the flow of life, it literally puts us into touch with alien forms of life. Alien forms of life that are on the frequency of mechanistic. And those are evil. Those are dark. So, I mean, and this is what my vision was leading me to toward the conclusion of. So that this mechanistic sort of dissociated worldview puts us into touch with other dark civilizations that don't see us as human. They see us as machines that they want to know how we work. So they may abduct us or rape us or rip. And these things come through a lot of different forms. One thing you can think about is all of the, you know, there's various, of course, entire very interesting histories that Graham Hancock has on UFOs and on Earth and in ancient Mayan civilizations, all this. It wasn't really that for me, you know. For me, it was more of understanding that the alienation comes through what I give my attention to. And a lot of what I was giving my attention to were cliches. And cliches are mechanical. And what is mechanical is alien. And what is alien connects us with this dark mechanistic dimension. And within that dimension, there are beings that start coming into our consciousness. And that affects how we live. So that the whole vision that night was essentially about me puking out a lot of things that were a part of mechanistic cultural cliches that were alienating me and exposing me to very dark energies.
Dualism in the bicameral mind.
Yeah, that's another beautiful one. I love that. That book's very interesting.
Adam, when you say aliens, you're not necessarily saying something that's from another planet. It's more like something from another dimension, something that's over on this world.
Yeah, but we don't see. It could be both. I mean, like I'm really open, after all these things that I've seen, I feel just tremendously open. You know, like I can honestly say that, like, you know, at this point, if it were to be disclosed that, you know, alien life had been discovered by the government in physical forms and spaceships and things like that, I wouldn't be in the least surprised. I mean, I would probably be like amazed, but I wouldn't be like, oh my God, I can't believe it. You know, but I'm more interested in the idea that because I've also seen that there are entities that exist in disembodied, or not disembodied, but in forms that are not material or of the same density as our own, like angels and spirits and so forth. And in those spaces, there are dark ones too. And so I'm fascinated by the idea of, you know, alien influence in a similar way as sort of classic Christian demonic influence. But you could also think of aliens as angels. Like, I think alien is just one word that we use for a lot of different things.
Yeah, I would say that there's a very fine distinction between the two. What could be angels to someone else could be an alien. What could be an alien to someone else could be an angel or a demon. I say it's like kind of a matter of perspective.
Right. I tend to agree with that. You know, and I'm also not totally, I mean, you know, sometimes I feel like literalizing all of this stuff, and then, you know, other times I feel really, like, close to some of the opinions of, like, Carl Jung, just that you know, spirits are, like, our experience of the spirits, well, or the bicameral mind, right, that just the idea that some of these entities are feel incarnate to us because of the difficulty that we have of understanding the different hemisphere relations of the brain and the unconscious.
Yeah.
And so some of these things truly just come from within us, you know?
I would say that in the alien abduction experience, which is something I've studied a lot, that it seems to me personally that it is an experience that is inward and not outward. In other words, that it's not really aliens coming down in a nuts and bolts spaceship, that it's something that is in the mind of the person that's being abducted. However, it's not necessarily an unreal experience. Mm-hmm.
Right.
But these are real things that are doing it, but it's not necessarily physical.
Right, you know, and that's something McGilchrist says in this new book he wrote about the brain. He says essentially that a lot of schizophrenics and their some of the breaks that they experience could be because of trauma or like, you know, lesions or something on one hemisphere of the brain versus the other, that and I don't think he wants to reduce the experience to a material phenomenon, but I think that what he wants to do is say, you know, look at the way in which this phenomenon is internal, as you're saying.
You mentioned schizophrenics, and I was going to get to that about how at a certain point you had actually worked with schizophrenics in a hospital. And
yes.
How did your experiences with ayahuasca, how did that help you to deal with people with schizophrenia?
Right. It was very complex because I was working a couple of things. I was working for the Franciscans at a Franciscan residence home. So it wasn't a hospital. It was like a residential assisted sort of living situation.
Okay.
And so I had the dynamics of the Catholic Church. And that bureaucracy, as well as the dynamics of you know, the states and, you know, city of New York and the social system. And then I had the schizophrenics themselves that I was friends with and worked with. And at the exact same time, I was publishing a book about ayahuasca and drinking a lot of ayahuasca. And so it was, I mean, it was, first thing is that it was incredibly stressful, you know.
Not to interrupt, Adam, but you weren't actually, at that time, you weren't actually going to Peru. You were doing the ayahuasca in New York. Is that, that's correct?
Right. Yeah, that's, okay. That's right.
Wow.
So, and that's a whole different story. I don't really want to go into that, but,
yeah.
But yeah, so it was very intense time, and the experiences, you know, first and foremost, were quite clearly, you know, I was able to have a kind of interior look at the phenomenon of what people were going through, and to be able to understand it in a way that a lot of other my coworkers, except for some of them who had been there for a very long time, could understand. And you know, that's not to brag or anything. I just purely attribute it to the nature of the ayahuasca work. For example, you know, schizophrenics will be stabilized by a cocktail of drugs, most of which are you know, have a huge array of devastating side effects.
Yeah.
And so they're handicapped by the side effects. They're also, the diagnosis is a kind of a garbage diagnosis a lot of the times. People aren't even sure what schizophrenia is. I mean, that's the doctors that I worked with, you know, and at the same time, they're schizoaffective, meaning they may also be bipolar or have any number of other different sort of behavioral things going on. But at any rate, what I would notice would be that they'll decomp. A lot of schizophrenics will go through periods of time where they'll be stable because of the meds, but then something will happen. And they will decompensate. They will kind of have a break, and then they'll have to be hospitalized. Their meds will have to be shifted up, changed, something. And then there's this period where they're pretty crazy for a while, and then they come back into a normalization. And that pattern is obviously terrifying to watch. I mean, we had people, you know, there's a guy who jumped out a window while I was there. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that you see that's pretty gnarly. I mean, I didn't see him jump out the window, but that kind of stuff is pretty gnarly, and it's very traumatizing because you recognize the position that they're in. Having been in positions like that myself in the Amazon, in these horrifying experiences, or, you know, that same work week while I might have gone to a ceremony, and you understand where the experience is coming from, and what you see is, you know, I don't want to simplify it, but in some regards, what you see is the complete inadequacy of the medical and social and religious systems to be able to accurately understand what is even happening. And, you know, what a decomp is, what the world looks like from the schizophrenic point of view. And I don't say, again, I don't want to simplify, say, oh, when you drink ayahuasca, it's like becoming a schizophrenic, but yeah. It gives you a certain kind of insight. And it also gives you an insight into what is the trigger for the decomp. So a lot of the times, like, for example, someone will come up with a great idea to try and make someone zip up his pants because his fly's always down. And, you know, you'll tell him to, and he won't do it, or he won't respond. And then you'll bug him about it again, and you'll bug it about him again day after day. And then finally, you know, he'll zip up his pants. And you'll, you know, cheer him on like he's a little boy who's just accomplished something. And then, you know, he's in the hospital. And it's like, you know, but the thing is that nobody, a lot of the times in those cases, 3/4 of the staff are not able to sense what it was that triggered him, you know. And you can see it's the small little thing that's a part of his routine, or that's a part of, you know, the way that this person keeps sanity together. And what you realize in the ayahuasca experience is very similar. Sanity is something that we all keep together, a lot of us, mostly through a lot of very elaborate illusions and lies. And once those things, which are much more complex for those of us who aren't schizophrenic, once those things are penetrated, we too will lose our shit. you know, but we have better support systems, and, you know, our degree of trauma and the break we experience is not going to be anywhere as bad. I mean, these are a lot of people who became homeless and then were raped in parks or set on fire, or, I mean, this is really dark stuff. So, you know, the way that we can reassemble the world after a break into another fancy, another sort of, sometimes another fancy lie is, it also makes you realize that sometimes the process of what someone is going through as a schizophrenic may be spiritually much more profound than what sober people are going through in terms of, you know, why is this person where they're at karmically in this lifetime? It gives you a deep respect, because after 2 hours of going through hell, you imagine, yeah, what would 2 weeks of a decompensation be like, you know? What is this person learning? What are they going through? What are they maybe burning off karmically? A lot of different questions come in, and I guess, you know, at the end of the day, it's just, it creates a deep level of compassion and empathy to work with people like this, and also it just takes away a lot of presumption that we have about sickness, I think.
All right, I got another couple more for you. I think on a documentary that some people felt like their ayahuasca experiences got easier the more they did, and then some people felt like it was just as intense every single time. For you, did it get easier, or did it stay just as intense?
It's sort of like the Zen, you know, the Zen teaching, I think it is, that once a mountain is a mountain, and then a mountain is a hill, and then again it's a mountain. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, it has to do with seasons of growth and change. So, you know, it's just, to me now, I almost look at it like, oh, you know, what was this winter like? You know, what was this summer like? And you kind of get a feel for the specificity of what the waves are like, or what the weather was like on a certain day or something, you know. And for me, ayahuasca is a lot like that. I've detached from the whole idea of whether or not it gets easier, because if you want it to be easier, first of all, it's probably going to get harder. And then if you take stock, you know, if you start kind of counting your blessings or something, like, oh, I'm getting better at this or something, like, mm-hmm. You know, generally speaking, when I've taken that kind of attitude, I just get knocked on my butt again. So right. you end up sort of staying open to whatever happens. And I was kind of going back to the schizophrenic example, and you find ways of staying sane through the experience. And they're very, you know, like something very simple that for me was a big deal for a while during ayahuasca practice was prayer beads. Throughout the whole night, no matter what, I would hold my prayer beads. And even though I would go through absolute hell, there would be these moments where I would realize that I still have my prayer beads in my hand. And when you come back and you look at the prayer beads, you're like, I get it. I get thousands of years of why people have held on to these things. You know, it doesn't really matter what kind of prayer beads they are or anything like that. It could, you know, could be a rock. I don't know. But I guess the point is that, you know, more and more, I think what the practice builds in you is a sort of peace that passes understanding, to use a Christian phrase. You know, it's like you're able to be with really raucous experiences and really blissful ones, but not really get attached to either. So it's sort of Buddhist in that way.
Wow. Okay. My other question, taking away the plane tickets, all the extra expenses and everything else, could you give me an approximate cost of what it would be to go to one of these resorts?
Yeah, well, that's unfortunate, because when I first went, it was cheap. I mean, relatively cheap compared to what it probably is today.
Right.
I mean, you know, when I first went, it probably cost me somewhere between $1,500 and $2,000 for everything.
Wow.
You know, and that was it. And now you're going to spend probably about $1,500 to $2,000 at the lodge if you're going to stay for like a 10-day, you know, full-on retreat. If you go, there's some places that are going to be more like $120-$130 a night, you know, and those, there's some good places that are like in that range. So maybe you go for 5 or 6 nights, you spend $500 or $600. And then, you know, your airfare is probably going to be about $1,000. And,
right.
And then got your food and everything, which isn't much, and you know, you can get away with the trip for, I would imagine, still $1,500 to $2,000. But you know, for some of the more like I think some of the places that are like Blue Morpho, you know, is one lodge. Although, you know, I'm not in the business of recommending lodges anymore because they all have their drama. But
right, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, any of the lodges down there that, you know, probably going to be like 15 to 2,000 nowadays for the ones that are going to have like a very nice structured experience with lots of things you can do and jungle hikes and, you know, more touristy. But there are places that are simpler that are also very reputable. Spirit of the Anaconda is one that I've drank at that I really appreciated. Temple of the Way of Light, that's another one that I a lot of good people I know enjoy that lodge.
Okay. So Adam, what are you doing now? What is it? What's in the future for you? And what's in the future for you?
Right now, what I'm really doing a lot of is obviously astrology. That's my kind of love. That's what grew for me out of this experience, other than creative writing, which, you know, I said I was in graduate school at the time for creative writing. But since then, really, what's grown out of the experience for me has, you know, gradually what I started actually sort of apprenticing myself to during ayahuasca ceremonies was the planetary intelligence and divination. So the I Ching and astrology in particular came for me from these experiences. And I just threw myself into the study of these things, and I started a kind of a community study group in 2000. By 2011, it had turned into a full-on year-long certification course for counseling astrologers. So now I have a full-time practice. I see clients all year round, and as you speak, you know, I speak at places, you know, semi-regularly, and writing a new book about psychedelics and mysticism, which I'm really excited about. And I teach a lot of students. I have 27 astrology students right now, so it's a full plate.
Oh, wow. And this next book, is it going to be more, is it going to be more of like a personal reflection as the last one was, or is this more of kind of an exploration, information?
Yeah, no, this one's personal as well. Okay. I mean, I like to really like, you know, when I was in my MFA program in creative writing, I studied memoir. And what I really appreciate are people who know how to tell their story, like their life story or some aspect or perspective of their life, in a way that you know, it feels like you're watching a very interesting movie, or it engages you like fiction rather than like straight up confessional, like, and then when I was, you know, like Chunk in the Goonies, like, and then I was 7, I puked in a movie theater. And
I got it.
So that kind of style is what, sure. is what I'm into.
I got to tell you, I finished your book today, as I told you before, and I don't think I've read a more brutally honest book. The things that you recount in there about your story, I'm not sure I could ever put anything like that to in my own life into paper. So I really commend you for your bravery and courage for doing that.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, I mean, sometimes I look at it, you know, there are days when I look at the entire project and I think, how selfish for someone to sit there and, you know, talk about themselves and their life and all these gory details. And then there's other times where I get feedback like what you said, or, you know, I had a man email me last fall that I've become friends with who, he went and drank ayahuasca as a result of reading my book, and, you know, he got sober. He was an alcoholic for more than a decade and got sober, and you know, there was something for him about the bravery of self-disclosure in the book that helped him step forward. And those are the things I like to hear. But, you know, is a back and forth thing. As a memoir writer, you always kind of wonder if you're navel gazing or if you're being kind of self obsessed, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like the way that you did it. I like the way that you you switched back and forth from your life to your experiences with ayahuasca. So it moved very well, and it's a very well written book too.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Luke, is there anything you want to ask? Or?
I'm sure I could come up with some more questions.
I think you could.
You know, being that I am so interested in going down there someday, you know, if I ever get that kind of money and going through the whole experience, because, you know, there's definitely some things that I would like to correct. alcoholism being one of them, I'd say, even though I'm
well,
not...
Well, you know...
Go ahead.
No, that's. I mean, I say to people a lot, you know, there's, especially if you hang out with the Evolver communities, if you're familiar with the Evolver networks and the Evolver meetup groups, there are, you know, there are shamans that come to the United States and travel that are legitimate and good, and you know, that network is the closest I know of to a hookup in the means of just there's a lot of good people who do good shamanic work in the United States and know of where to go to drink ayahuasca that you might connect with. But that's not to say that, you know, Evolver has no connection with it. It's just that those
right.
types of groups, you know, is one that I know of where people run in those kind of circles. So that might be an option for you too, because it's not, you know, there's nothing wrong with a ceremony happening in the United States. You'd be surprised if, you know, if you found out how many different interesting people, you know, high profile people are drinking ayahuasca regularly in the United States. So
I'm sure of it.
It's, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. At the same time, it's like if I had to recommend to anyone, I would say if you can go to the Amazon first, you know, so you really have the authentic flavor of the experience.
Full experience.
I think
genuine.
What's his name? Joe Rogan is a big proponent of it. The comedian.
He's quite a character. I think he's. I'm really thankful for just his voice out there.
Yeah. Well, Adam, before we let you go, tell us where people can get your book and where they can get in touch with you, your website.
Oh, yeah, right on. So my book is Fishers of Men, The Gospel of an Ayahuasca Vision Quest. It was published by Tarcher Penguin in 2010. You can get it on Amazon. That's the easiest way. You know, it's a tough thing. I'm always like, buy it new on Amazon because that helps my sales. But then, you know, I also don't want used business people to go out. So I'm like, well, go to the used bookstore and get it. It doesn't really matter. You can get it there. You can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or stuff like that. And if people want to get a hold of me, they want to, you know, do an astrology reading, or which is just a fantastic way to really probe some of these deep places. And I truly think that one of the things that makes Nightlight unique is an astrology school, and, you know, my own practice. I really try to bring some of the more piercing insights and healing knowledge that I've learned through these experiences into how I do astrology. And there's a lot of other good astrologers out there who I think are starting to do similar things. So it's kind of a neat time. You can check that out at nightlightastrology.com. It's NIGHT, like night, and then LIGHT, like light, astrology. And the school's there too. So if folks are interested in studying astrology and that, they can check that out. Otherwise, the readings are listed there as well. And then, you know, if folks are in the Maryland area or the DC area, our yoga studio is called Sky House Yoga. And you can check that out at skyhouseyoga.com.
Excellent. Adam, we'll have to get you back on to talk about astrology.
I would love that.
That's like a whole other show. So
that's great. Yeah, I'm interested in that as well.
That's a whole awesome conversation in and of itself for sure.
Interesting. All right, well, stay in the line for us. We're gonna go over here to break, and we'll be right back on Conspiranormal. All right, we're back on Conspiranormal. Luke, I know that you really, really appreciated that one.
Shabang!
So what'd you think, man?
Yeah, I mean, like I was just telling you before we came back, he reminds me a lot of my brother.
Uh-huh.
And he seems like he's done as much, if not more, research. I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you, your brother's, you know, he's into some deep stuff, too. He's a real deep thinker.
I guarantee you, he's read most of the same books as he has.
Yeah.
And I'm going to recommend the show to him immediately, too, after you post it, because he'll love it. He'll eat it up.
Absolutely. So, what are your thoughts on ayahuasca now?
Well,
even more affirmed.
Right, exactly. you know, I told you, I've actually have, you know, quite a bit of information on it, because I did internet research, and I've watched three separate documentaries about it, and all of these people, all these different people are talking about their experiences and stuff, and
yeah.
how it worked for them, and each individual took something different away from it, and how I kind of view it from what it sounds like is like shrooms and weed combined. You know, just
it sounds like it's even more powerful.
Well yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying.
I mean, it sounds like it's the most powerful hallucinogenic drug
in the world.
Take.
Yeah, right. And there's a whole long list of hallucinogenics out there in the world. Like you've got these tribes that I forget what it's called, a putong or something like that. You know, where they blow it into the cane poles into their face, yeah. and it coats their face in this powder, and then they lick the poisonous frogs. The toxin gives them visions and
yeah.
stuff like that. You know, so it's all over the world, but ayahuasca definitely seems like a really good, well-rounded, balanced aid in helping you have those visions and correct those insufficiencies and stuff with yourself.
Well, the main reason I wanted to have Adam on was to, you know, for him to talk about his experiences, and I think it's important that people understand, and we did touch on this with him in the interview, was how, you know, this goes into kind of the realm of the supernatural too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there are these things that are, you know, that are kind of beyond our reality, that kind of lurk
right.
on the other side of our reality, and that when something like ayahuasca is taken or some other hallucinogenic drug, we often encounter these kind of beings.
So that alone makes them very real. And it's in someone who sees in more of like a two-dimensional outlook, just they're like, well, I, you know, the demon's not in front of me. I've never seen an apparition of a demon in front of me talking to me, because what is in your mind is just as real as what you're seeing physically, you know.
Sure.
And he makes that very like literally, literarily, or however, whatever word for it, nicely put. You know, I can't speak the same way.
Well, it seems to me that it's very possible that ancient man took these kind of drugs and had these same kind of experiences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, definitely kind of the cave paintings, the ancient cave paintings,
mm-hmm.
they're all much more stylized. So it seems to me that those kind of, this kind of thing is as old as humanity
exactly.
itself.
And just recently, it's become a big deal, you know.
Right.
People are even going to different things like what's it called, Sage's Brush. People have been doing it in the past few years. They've just made it illegal. I forget what it's called right now.
But the salvia.
Salvia. Yeah. Salvia.
He actually talks about using salvia in his book.
Did he do it too?
Yeah, he's done it too.
He's a warrior, man.
You know. If you want to do that, all that stuff, more power to you, but for me, I don't know. I'd have to just...
Well,
I don't know if I'm ready to face all those demons yet.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've felt like my entire life, you got to face it. And
yeah.
Well, just talking about, like, without any kind of drugs at all, just say you're alone in your living room or whatever, there's nobody else in the house, there's no TV on, there's nothing to distract you, you're still going to face them. All of those thoughts that were building and you've been ignoring because you're at work or you're doing something else to distract yourself, they're still going to come up and you still have to face them. But it's like when you take the ayahuasca, just boom, like accelerated. Like, there it is, face it now. You know, get past it.
And this is why people use stuff like alcohol and drugs, you know, that are, or sex or anything to kind of distract
just
you.
As a distraction.
From your, like, from the demons that you have in you. he is a very... very interesting person, and like I said, I'd love to get him on and talk about astrology, which is something I don't really know anything about, but apparently
you know
a little more something about it than I do.
I've gotten into it a little bit more here in the recent years, And it's really fascinating to me that so many old timers will stick by it, you know.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, I grow my crops on Wednesday nights on the 15th of every April, and you know, all these,
like the farmer's almanacs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All these specific times, and it's like, and the thing is, you know, a lot of people think that it's just for planting cycles and gardening and stuff and fishing, but really it encompasses so much more. It encompasses when to start a relationship, when to go look for a potential mate, when to things with your career, when to try to ask for a promotion, when would be a good time. You know, all of these things they used to believe were had these perfect just schedule events, you know, scheduled times that it would be best that you attempted something like that.
Sure.
It's crazy.
Is there anything else you want to share?
I guess not, man.
Well, here, you've been reading some of these wonderful Facebook posts over here.
Yeah, so, I
some
am.
Some of the mundane stuff.
I am kind of a Facebook hooker. I can't I can't help it, man. I like to see what's going on in everyone's life. And
yeah.
I'm nosy, too. It's probably just more nosiness than anything. I just like to see what's going on with everybody.
Right. Well, I think I'm about ready to call it a night. There's not much more we can really talk about. So, you know, Chris wasn't here again. I know all the Chris fans are disappointed. They probably turned off the show.
You know,
Chris wasn't on the show.
We've got so many listeners now that we should, like, have some Chris t-shirts and stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
But like his face with a question mark on it.
Yeah, and some kind of like... It's some kind of like raffle on the show or something like that. And one, you go the,
win a free date with Chris. I'm sure everybody would really appreciate that. Yeah, he texted me and told me he wasn't on. He wasn't coming tonight. So whatever. But
whatever. I hope he doesn't listen to these.
I don't know if he does or not.
He's gonna feel like we just dog him.
Well, he's not here. Anyway, next time I've got scheduled Nick Redfern to come on. And Nick is someone who's known, very well known in the paranormal community. The guy's written like 20,000 books. And we're going to be talking about a book called Final Events. And we'll also probably talk to Nick about his life and in the paranormal. And he'll be our first British guest. So... we'll have some British accents up in here.
Oh, boy.
So, but...
I'll have to tell Cody to listen to the show.
I may schedule another show before then. I'm not quite sure. I haven't gotten a guest yet to come on. But if anything, maybe just like Luke can burp his ABCs or something to the microphone. So
I've always wondered if someone could fart a song.
He'll be saving lives at his job.
Yeah.
So.
I'll probably be just sit there just sleeping underneath my glasses so nobody can see me, and then someone's drowning and I get fired.
Yeah. You'll have to leave the state or something. Anyway, we're gonna call it a night. So just guys, join us next time on
Conspiranormal. This time I Casey.